From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how the Women's March movement grew beyond the 2017 march in Washington and continues to evolve.
This year, I think we took to the streets again, and we have several times, but this is really marked by the move that we're going to take forward this year. We're calling it, we're marching on to the polls. We're taking our power to the polls this year.
We'll meet Kenosha native Will Ray, who's currently playing J.M. Barry in the national tour of the Broadway musical Finding Neverland.
And learn what we get from the secrets shared by strangers on a website and in a stage play.
Secrets are almost like invitations into a stranger's life and help us realize the extraordinary stories of heroism and frailty playing out in the people all around us.
Plus passing notes and the latest edition of Bubbler Talk. Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Lawmakers in Madison continue trying to wrap up some of their legislative priorities during this election year session. Education is a hot topic there, as it is just about everywhere. The question is it a hot enough topic to make it into the agenda of our Rachel Morello?
Rachel is with us now for her weekly education news recap and quiz, which she calls Passing Notes. Hey there, Rachel.
Hey, Mitch. I'm back.
And it's good to see you.
You too. I have two questions for you today.
Okay, we'll see how much caffeine is in my system.
Okay, so the first question has to deal with statewide news. Over the past 2 weeks, both chambers of Wisconsin's legislature have passed a bill that could impact the way public schools are funded. What does the bill call for? A, an increase in per pupil funding, so more state money per student. B, allowing districts to raise property taxes without taking it to a vote. Or C, eliminating certain state aid programs.
I am going to say B.
B, allowing districts to raise property taxes without a vote?
Yeah, it seems unlikely, but I'm going to say B anyway.
You would be correct.
Ha ha!
So most people know that a portion of their taxes goes toward paying for public schools. And right now, in order for schools to raise that amount, they have to take it to a referendum on their local ballot. As we said, the bill that's going through the legislature right now would eliminate that requirement, but it would only apply to districts where voters haven't rejected a property tax increase in the past 3 years.
A district couldn't put something up to a referendum, have it get rejected, and then say, well, we're going to do it anyway.
Right. They'd have to wait at least 3 years. This would apply to about 100 districts out of 420-some in the state right now. And something else that's important to note is that this bill is aimed at low-spending districts, a term that usually applies to rural districts or districts that are sparsely populated.
What about districts that have not had a referendum either ever or in a really long time? They could just do it?
I would assume so, because they would still fall under that requirement.
Does the bill talk about caps in terms of how much property taxes could be raised?
It does. Lawmakers thought about that. They don't want it to be like some exorbitant amount, but they do want to give, particularly these districts that don't get a lot of money in state aid because they don't have a lot of students, the opportunity to raise some of the funds that would catch them up to other districts. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I'll make sure to put them on the website so people can go and check them out there.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah. Okay, so one for one. And the second question is a little more fun. Not that taxes aren't fun.
Oh, gosh, taxes are so much fun.
Okay, so MSOE, the Milwaukee School of Engineering, announced a new degree program that's going to start next fall. And the focus of the degree is pretty unique, not only to MSOE, but to the region in general. What is the focus, Mitch? Is it A, animation, B, information security, or C, artificial intelligence?
I'm going to go with artificial intelligence because I have seen it on a billboard.
What?
They have a billboard up that says AI. Yes, MSOE AI.
Lots of letters.
And I didn't really read it beyond that, but you said artificial intelligence, and I thought that is what the billboard is about.
And you thought correct. When most people think AI, they might think of that movie. They might think of robots taking over the world. But this would be a computer science degree. That's the main degree, but it would have an AI focus.
Instead, it's engineers taking over the world.
Instead of robots. So here's how MSOE describes it. They say graduates will be prepared to write cutting-edge software to solve tomorrow's problems with a special emphasis on machine learning and artificial intelligence. So in this context, they're talking about machine learning. That's things like smart speakers like Alexa or Google Home or self-driving cars, things like that.
Alexa, play this clip.
Here is Dr. Derek Riley, the computer science program director at MSOE.
The idea that if you get a computer science degree, you're going to end up in, you know, a cubicle somewhere is really a thing of the past. The other big myth that's worth addressing is that artificial intelligence is going to take over the world. The reality is the techniques that we have to do machine learning right now are very effective at certain sets of problems. But this idea of transferring the intelligence from one context to another is a really hard and open problem in artificial intelligence, that we're likely to see artificial intelligence enhance productivity for a lot of people and make their lives easier. In the same way that, you know, if you get an emergency situation, a new car now will often break for you, or you'll see ads that are related to your interests and your search history. Those are all artificial intelligence driven that are, in theory, meant to improve our lives. We'll see more of that, I think, as opposed to artificial intelligence systems that will take over a specific job.
Alexa, turn Rachel's microphone back on.
Whew, thanks. There are a lot of computer science programs. That's not necessarily new, but AI focus is usually a graduate level program or at least a junior senior level class. This degree would allow freshmen to start taking those classes right away.
So this is a 4-year undergraduate program.
It is.
Exciting.
Yeah, and it'll be up and running by fall. So students who are applying now could join that program.
Could both of us go back to school and do that?
Maybe. Would you want to?
I don't know. There are some things, personally, that I derive enjoyment from doing as a human being that I know a machine could probably do and do better, but the enjoyment part of it, honestly, this is why I still drive a manual transmission.
Yes. Well, in the way that he described it, it'll take them a long time and a lot of progress before we see anything that will take over, like he said, anyone's job or a singular task. So this might freak some people out, but I think our fears will be calmed for quite a while at least.
Alexa, thank Rachel for me.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
Rachel Morello is WUWM's education reporter. You can hear more of her work or drop her a line with suggestions for education stories at WUWM.com/education.
The women's march that coincided with Donald Trump's inauguration as president in 2017 drew hundreds of thousands of people to Washington, D.C. It helped build a movement that has extended well past that single event.
Other marches have taken place in the time since as well, including one in Milwaukee in January. The marches and rallies draw people in support of issues ranging from sexual harassment to pay equity to women's health.
Sarah Pearson attended the first march in Washington and was inspired enough to come back to Milwaukee to begin the Wisconsin chapter of the Women's March organization. She talked with Lake Effect's Claudia Delgadillo about how she was drawn to the effort.
I love my job as a restaurant manager, and if you're familiar at all with the restaurant industry, it's a lot of hours. It's a lot of nights and weekends, so I'm used to that kind of schedule. And after the 2016 election, I realized that I wanted to put my time and my energy towards something that I felt would make a big difference on a larger scale. So that's why I was drawn to Women's March. One of the tenets or the core goals of Women's March Wisconsin in our mission statement is harnessing the political power of diverse groups of women to create transformative social change. So I was always interested, I guess, in politics and sort of the politics as it related to women. So being a part of Women's March gives me an opportunity to focus on politics and focus on how we as women can use our power to advance social change.
Now, this is the second march in Wisconsin, correct?
Yeah. So last year there was a women's march. It was the largest single day protest ever. So I was actually at the march in D.C., but there was also a march that took place in Madison. So we're a newly formed chapter. So our anniversary days of action that we held on January 20th, that was a great day for us. We saw a lot of people come out around the state with our main events being in Milwaukee, Green Bay, and Eau Claire. But we're going to continue working throughout the year. So the work isn't done, and it doesn't just happen in January. We have a lot of goals for the upcoming year, and we're going to continue organizing.
Have the goals changed at all since the first march?
I mean, I would say the goals of creating that the kind of transformative social change that we want to see hasn't really wavered from the beginning. But I think that our focus has had to shift, especially as we're moving towards midterm elections this year. So the first year was sort of this moment of women coming together and saying, like, we're not okay with this. We're taking to the streets. And this year, I think we took to the streets again, and we have several times, but this is really marked by the move that we're going to take forward this year. We're calling, we're marching on to the polls. We're taking our power to the polls this year. So our goals in terms of what we'd like to see in as social change take place haven't changed, but we're definitely harnessing that focus and taking it towards the elections in 2018.
Why is it important for men to be visible?
We need to have allies. It's not a movement, or the movement can't just be women advocating for ourselves. We need men to advocate with us. In order for this change to happen, we're only 50% or maybe a tiny little bit more of the population in the United States. So we need men standing by our side as allies in order to move forward. So we need them there. I think that the difference between Women's March and other groups is that it's women-led. So men can certainly participate.
And at the march, you mentioned that immigration was also an issue that the movement wanted to cover. Mm-hmm. How are you going about that?
So we've already participated in a few actions. I actually, along with one of my one of our regional directors from the southeastern Wisconsin area, and we were arrested in D.C. a few weeks ago in protest of what's happening and what was taking place in the Senate. The government, if you've been following, the government did shut down briefly, and Senate Democrats sort of put their feet down on a Friday and said, we're not going to allow this budget to move forward, you know, unless there's a DREAM Act. And then on Monday, they sort of reversed their position and didn't stand with the Dreamers in the way that we felt they should. So I was actually arrested in D.C. that day in solidarity with the Dreamers, and we're going to continue standing with them. We still don't have a clean DREAM Act. We were asking for a clean DREAM Act by the end of last year, and that's not something that happened. So as Women's March, we absolutely stand with the Dreamers and with those that are fighting for them. And, I mean, there are deportations that are happening every single day. So the urgency for Clean Dream Act to be passed is very, very high. And I think what we ask women in particular, those who attended our events, to understand is that part of what intersectional feminism is it's not just a feminism that's centered on reproductive rights or access to them. If we don't stand with immigrant women, then we don't stand with women, because the most marginalized groups and the ones who are the most vulnerable need to be centered in our movement. So that's why we really need to uplift those whose immigration status is really in peril right now.
So in your opinion, do you think that this movement is large enough, is big enough to fight for all of these issues that have to do with women?
Absolutely. I believe that especially if we ensure that the most marginalized groups are represented within our leadership, we definitely have the people that we need to continue this fight. I mean, we saw on January 21st, 2017, the largest single day protest ever. So there are people out there. So what we need as Women's March, or what we ask for, is that the women who did come out on those days of action on January 21st, 2017, don't stop fighting. We need them to show up at the rallies that are more difficult, like show up at a protest for the Dreamers, show up at a Black Lives Matter rally, show up for trans women when they need you. So I believe that the numbers are there. Or one of our national co-chairs, Linda Sarsour, says, you know, in November 2016, we weren't outnumbered, we were out-organized. So we just need to continue organizing. And we do that by centering the most marginalized groups in our leadership.
What are the next steps for this movement?
Part of our plan for the next year revolves around power to the polls. So our national chapter kicked off their anniversary day of action in Las Vegas, Nevada. So Nevada is a swing state, and they feel that that's a state where they could really make a lot of impact by registering some voters. So that's what they did on January 21st. So we're sort of transforming that rage and that anger, that hurt that we felt after Trump was elected, and taking that to the polls. We're taking our power there. So they started in Las Vegas, Nevada, and we will be coming through Wisconsin this year. So we plan to work with the national chapter and alongside our allies throughout the state to register as many voters as possible so that we can reclaim some of that power in 2018. And we're going to continue defending women around the country for some of the issues that I talked about earlier. We're going to continue fighting for the Dreamers. We're going to continue fighting for trans women. We're going to continue fighting for access to clean water. There's a lot of work to be done, but our focus on those issues and on taking back our power at the polls in 2018 has to remain at the center of what we do.
Sarah Pearson is the founder of the Wisconsin chapter of Women's March. She spoke with Lake Effect's Claudia Delgadillo.
A quick break now, and when we return, we'll meet the Kenosha native currently starring in the Broadway national tour of Finding Neverland on stage at the Marcus Center. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. For decades, audiences have adored Peter Pan, the fantasy character created by Scottish author J.M. Barrie at the turn of the 20th century. The story of the boy who never grew up has been adapted for stage, screen, and television many times since its creation.
The most recent incarnation tells the backstory of how the character came to be in the first place. The musical Finding Neverland played for almost a year and a half on Broadway and has been on a national tour ever since. Our next guest, Kenosha native Will Ray, stars in that tour as the author, J.M. Barrie. He's in the studio with us now. Will Ray, it is such a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Bonnie.
It is so great to talk to somebody like yourself who grew up in the area. You grew up in Kenosha.
I did.
Went to high school in Kenosha, did, you know, your sort of early training in musical theater there, and now you're back on tour with like a national tour. And so how did this all happen? You know, how did you get interested in musical theater in the first place?
Well, it's actually a really interesting story. I grew up playing sports all my life. My dad was a college coach down at Carthage College, and I joined choir my freshman year at Bullen Junior High, and then sophomore year came to Bradford High School, and there I still played, you know, captain of our football team, played basketball, ran track, and one of our directors, Nick Storino, came into choir one day and was like, "We're doing Guys and Dolls this spring. We need guys in the show. Please come and audition." And, you know, a number of the guys in choir already did the musicals, and I was like, "You know what? All right, I'll do it. Sure, if you don't mind that I miss a few rehearsals because of track practice, sure, I'll do it." And the day before auditions, I found out that we had to audition and sing in front of everyone that was auditioning in this huge auditorium. And I said, "Nope."
And so you turned
down. I chickened out. No. I chickened out. Didn't do it. So then I kind of had the summer to think about things. And they were doing a production of Carousel that fall.
More guys.
Mm-hmm. So my mom actually was like, "I will pay you $20 to audition. I dare you to," basically. And I said, "All right, I'll do that. Give me $20. I'll do it." And we also had to audition in a little tiny room with just the director. And
which is kind of what you usually
expect.
That's
totally what you do. So I was like, "All right, I'll do it." And ended up getting cast as Enoch Snow. And literally the rest is history. I caught the bug. I loved it. I fell in love with, you know, with theater and musical theater. And Holly Stanfield, who's the director down at Kenosha Bradford right now, really took me under her wing, you know, and said, "Hey, there's something there. You could do this for a living. You could go to school for this." And I was like, "What? You know, that you could even study this in school? I didn't even know college, you know, offered this." So
were you thinking you were going to be a sports guy in college?
Yeah, I don't know what I thought I was going to do. Probably certainly played sports in college. You know, maybe be a teacher or psychology. That always kind of interested me.
All theater related.
Yeah, no, yeah. Totally,
yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
I'd never acted. I didn't know anything other than maybe going to a couple of field trips and seeing a couple of shows, you know, in middle school or something. But really fell in love with it and saw about as much theater as one could possibly see in between Milwaukee and Chicago. Auditioned at a bunch of different schools. And they have these big unified auditions in Chicago and all the big musical theater schools come and audition. And ended up deciding to go to the University of Cincinnati's College Conservatory of Music. And the rest is kind of history. You know, I went and studied there and, you know, it was a conservatory. So I was in dance class. I was in acting class. I was taking voice lessons.
Did you feel like you had a lot to make up for because you didn't really focus on it as a kid?
100%. I came in and everyone was rattling off these musicals that they had done and knew. And I was like, what?
I've
only been doing this for a couple of years. and I don't even, I don't know. I will say that Holly really... She really prepared me for as much as you can possibly prepare some guy who had no clue what he was doing. He thought acting was using a funny voice or something. I didn't know. She'd grown up doing theater in Chicago and then, you know, transitioned into teaching. So I was really lucky to have someone like her at the helm while in high school. But yeah, I definitely felt a little behind the curve compared to everyone who was coming in to University of Cincinnati.
Did it make you work harder?
Probably. Yeah, probably. You know, I just felt, yeah, that whole catching up kind of thing. But, you know, you're really immersed there. It's a conservatory. And you know, luckily when I would come home, I would go and see more shows in Chicago and Milwaukee. So by the time I had finished up and 2003, we were graduating, I had felt pretty good. We had gone to New York once with Holly and my mom and a couple of the kids from Bradford. We went my senior year to New York, and that's also another thing that kind of propelled, you know, this dream of moving to New York and becoming an actor. And
do you remember what you saw?
Oh, boy. The very first show I ever saw was Cabaret.
In New York?
In New York.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. It really blew me away. It's a very, very powerful show, which I'm sure, you know, and it just kind of reaffirmed that I was doing what I wanted to be doing and was in the right place.
I think it's interesting that you were, you know, really focused on sports first, because part of what I think a lot of people who are not in theater don't understand is the conditioning that you have to have in order to do what you're doing. Right now, you're on a national tour. You're doing 8 shows a week. You're traveling from place to place to place. That takes a whole lot of stamina.
Yeah, totally. It really is a grueling schedule. And I guess what makes up for it is that I'm doing what I love to do. You know, if people don't have a passion for performing, for getting to go out on stage 8 shows a week and doing what they love to do, then they wouldn't be doing this, because you have one day off a week, you have your Mondays off, and those are the days on tour that you travel. So depending on where you're flying to, if it's a small market theater or, you know, small market town, you're taking a bus from the hotel to the airport, you're going through security, you're getting on the airplane, you're flying somewhere, you're getting off that plane, you're going, waiting, you know, layover, getting on the next plane, flying
hoping
to the next place.
Late.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and of course that never happens.
No,
you know?
No.
But and then, you know, you get into the city, you get on another bus, you go to the hotel, you try to find some food, and the next thing you know, it's Tuesday, and you're back into the performance mode, rehearsals in the day, and, you know, it's the same old story all over again.
Right, and trying to get used to a new theater.
Exactly, exactly.
Because they're all different.
100%. You know, and backstage, you're like, wait, this is not what I remember. Oh, wait, we're in a new city.
Yeah.
You know, and when you've done it for, you know, 20, 30, 40 weeks on end, they kind of start to blur together, and... But yeah, it's.
Do you still get to do any kind of sports or working out to help you balance your, you know, the effort that you're putting out on stage?
I do. You know, that's part of the contract. We have a gym in each city that we go to, and so when I joined Finding Neverland back in almost a year now, March of last year, I was hired to be in the ensemble and understudy J.M. Barrie, who I now currently play. And that track was a lot different than J.M. Barrie is on stage for 2.5 hours.
Because you never get off,
no,
do you?
No, he's up there for 2.5 hours of a 2-hour and 40-minute show. I literally go off, change clothes, and you come back on. So I had a little more off stage time. in my ensemble track, so I did hit the gym a little bit more. But now I don't really need to go to the gym quite as much. I'll go a couple of times in the week just to do a little weight training, but as far as endurance, you know, I'm running around sweating my face off for most of the show.
Just trying to keep up with
exactly,
everything.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Taking care of yourself. You know, you kind of mentioned the schedule and everything. To be able to put out, because every audience is new and every audience deserves the best show that they can possibly get. And you have to do that. You and the rest of the cast have to do that, sometimes on not a lot of sleep, sometimes on not the best food, sometimes, you know, having been in a bed that's just really uncomfortable. How do you do that? How do you take care of yourself so that you can put yourself out there every night?
That's a great question, and I still am trying to figure it out. This is my second time touring here in the U.S., and, you know, you try to pick up little tidbits along the way. But what I try to do is try to find some kind of consistency, you know. I travel with this diffuser with different essential oils. So every time I come into my hotel room or, you know, apartment, if I have an Airbnb, you walk in and there's that familiarity when you walk in. I eat very similar kinds of meals, you know, and it's all about kind of finding the consistency. Usually on travel days, while I'm traveling, I will be looking up grocery stores and all different kinds of stuff to do throughout the week in this new city that we're going to, so that when I get there, I have a game plan. I have a schedule.
Isn't it a great thing that you have it all on your phone now?
Oh, God, I can't imagine doing this 25 years ago. I don't know how they did it.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't do as many
that
stops.
Could be.
Maybe they were longer stops.
That very well
or
could
something.
Be. That very well could be. Yeah. But it's a lifesaver. I don't know. Walking around certain cities, I am terrible with direction. So I don't know what I would do without my GPS and being able to look up, you know, the local grocery store, or, you know, local eatery.
Yeah. Let's talk about the show just a little bit. You said it's been almost a year that you've been part of this in different capacities. What is it about this show that makes you stay with it as long as you have, besides the paycheck? I mean, I know everyone wants to get paid to do what they love to do, but there must be something about this show.
Yeah, it is. Finding Neverland is a really special show because it is essentially the story of how J.M. Barrie wrote Peter Pan, which is probably one of the most, you know, well-known plays of our time. It's very magical. And as far as the show itself, there's something in the show for everyone. And that doesn't always happen with most shows. I mean, the kids love this show. Grown-ups love this show. You know, it will pull at your nostalgic heartstrings. You will laugh. You may shed a tear. And then you'll laugh some more. But at the end of the night, the audience jumps to their feet and just goes nuts for it because it hits home with everyone. You know, there is something truly for everyone in this show. And it's really special to be a part of something like that because it doesn't happen in every show that you do. And when you find a show like that, you stick with it, you know?
Well, it's funny. Have you ever been to the town in Scotland where he's from?
I haven't.
Oh, you should go.
I have
stood in his house.
You're kidding me.
And it is, you know, it's tiny. You'd probably hit your head on the ceiling, but it is an amazing place to sit there and you're looking out the windows. I mean, in the chairs, it's now a museum that you can walk through. And you say, this is a tiny little place. And this huge imagination came out of this tiny little house.
That's incredible. Yeah. I would love to do that. I'm actually going to stop over in London. I'm getting married in May.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And we're actually getting married in Italy. But before, we're going to pop into London to see a friend in a show on the West End. But man, I would love to jump over there and check that out.
Just go up to Edinburgh and then head north a little bit.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, you
I'd
should
love do, to do
it.
That. Yeah.
Particularly since you love this show so much. It's so connected because it is really quite amazing, you know, to do that. And as long as you're connected to the show, it will be something you can pull in.
Well, we're staying right next to Kensington Gardens, where he was kind of inspired by this family to write the show. So I'm very excited about that. So maybe we'll take a little day trip up.
I think you should.
Awesome.
I think you should. But Will Ray, congratulations, on getting married. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
And so glad to have you back in town for just a few days here. But thanks so much for stopping in.
It's good to be home. Thanks, Bonnie. Appreciate it.
Actor and Kenosha native Will Ray plays J.M. Barrie in the national tour of Finding Neverland. It's on stage at the Marcus Center through this weekend.
We'll take another break, and then the story of people, secrets, postcards, a website, and a play about those people, postcards, and secrets. We'll talk with the creator of Post Secret when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Storytelling is having a long moment in the sun, from national programs like The Moth to local ones like Exfabula. Telling our stories out loud in front of an audience seems to be something we want to do and to hear others do.
Post Secret is a bit different, even though it's been going on for a dozen years. The website describes it as an ongoing community art project where people mail in their secrets anonymously on one side of a postcard. The secrets range from the banal to the heart-wrenching, the postcards themselves from the spare to the grandly ornate, and for the past 12 years, they've been delivered to Frank Warren's home address in Maryland.
Warren started Post Secret out of curiosity, and at first he was surprised that people were willing to write a secret onto a card and then mail it to him. But now, as Post Secret the show arrives in Milwaukee next Thursday, we revisit our 2016 interview with Warren to learn how it all began.
I lived in a suburb. I had my own business, a wife and a daughter and a dog, and things were going pretty well. So I followed this lark and turned my life upside down by asking strangers to share a secret with me.
Why?
I think if you'd asked me at the time, I wouldn't have had a good reason. But looking back on it now, I think one of my motives, even though I didn't know it at the time, was because I was struggling with secrets in my own life. And there were parts of my past that I had buried and I needed to reconcile with. And by creating this safe place for other people to share their secrets, I needed that maybe just as much as anyone.
The Post Secret is described as an ongoing community art project, and the postcards themselves, it's not just what's on the postcard, it's the actual artifact. The postcards themselves play a huge part of this project. When did you first realize that you really had something going here?
When they started arriving, I would scan the postcards and the secrets and the artwork and post it on the web. And that first Sunday, I had maybe 100 visitors. The next Sunday to postsecret.com, I had 1,000. And the Sunday after that, I had 100,000. Very quickly, the idea spread virally around the world, and people began to buy their own postcards and make their own postcards. And they started arriving with postmarks from California and Texas and Wisconsin and Hong Kong and Sydney and Dublin. And they've been coming for 10 years. I feel like I accidentally tapped into something that had been waiting. There'll be postcards in my mailbox today. And the full collection themselves is it's over a ton of postcards, a pyramid, right now on display at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
What do you think it is about the act of writing it on a card and actually putting it in the mail to send to you that people tapped into? There's so many storytelling opportunities now, but this somehow is different, and it taps into something that obviously people were longing to do.
Well, the website's had over 700 million hits, but I don't think it's the digital part of this that's so significant. I think it's the depth of the stories that people are sharing and also the artifacts they're creating. I'm looking at a postcard right now that has a hand drawing with colored pencils of King Babar from the children's storybook. And the secret on this postcard reads, "When I was a child, I was constantly terrified that my entire life was just a story being read by King Babar to his children, and that someday he would close the book and my life would end."
Wow.
And as I hold this, it's got a postmark from Sacramento, California, my home address, a stamp, a cancellation mark. And I do think there's something significant about finding your own secret, taking ownership of it, putting it on this postcard, and then physically letting it go to a stranger. I think that act itself can in some cases, be a first step in a much longer journey to reconcile with that confession in a way that's healthy.
One of the things that you've been recognized for is mental health advocacy. Was that something that you thought of at the beginning with this? I'm sure you've heard and seen some pretty heartrending things that have come on those postcards.
Well, one of the things that makes me most proud of Post Secret is the Post Secret community collectively has raised over $1 million for suicide prevention. And I don't think there's a direct connection between suicide and Post Secret, but I do think that the project has kind of undercovered this American secret. It's a secret that we keep from ourselves about suicide. And before I started Post Secret, I was a volunteer on Hopeline, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. In some ways, listening to people share their secrets with me at 2 a.m. and 3 a.m., and that definitely informs the project.
One of the things that I think is part of the human condition is that we all have secrets, and some of them probably are more benign than others. What do you think this process does, and what have people who have written to you with their secrets, if you've met them, what have they told you that doing this act of writing down a secret has done for them?
I get follow-up emails from people almost daily talking about their secrets that they've seen in the Post Secret books or on the Post Secret website, talking about the rest of the story. I remember one that came from a woman who said that she went to the website and she saw a stranger's secret there. It was a secret that said, "I didn't realize I was in an abusive relationship until I understood that I had lost all of my opinions." And she said, "When I saw that secret from a stranger, I instantly recognized the same exact condition in my life, and I hadn't seen it before that." And she said, "It eventually led me to leave and get out of that unhealthy relationship." So one example of a person courageously exposing their life and impacting who knows how many other people.
The anonymity, of course, is so key here because, as you say, people need to feel safe to be able to give up some of these secrets. Is there ever a problem with secrecy where people are found out when they don't want to be?
There was one secret I remember that came from a woman. She wrote, "I worked all my life to get into Harvard, and now that I'm here, I hate it." And when I posted that, I heard from her a few days later. She identified what was on the back of the postcard, so I knew it was hers. And she said, "My friends and family have identified this secret as mine. They saw my handwriting, and now I'm feeling this pressure. Would you mind taking it down?" So I did. I removed it immediately, but I emailed her back, and I said, "Even though you're feeling this pressure right now, short term, it might be what you need to move to a place on campus where you're a better fit or transfer to a school you like better." And I think that's something we can learn about all of our secrets, how sometimes it's much more comfortable to keep our secrets inside and not mention them. It leads to a peacefulness, perhaps, but maybe that's a false peacefulness. And maybe in the long run, the healthiest thing we can do is out those parts of our life that are uncomfortable and might lead to difficult conversations, but ultimately take us to where we need to be.
Have there ever been secrets that come to you where you think, "Oh my gosh, I don't know how to help this person"?
Yes, but I don't think most people want my help. I think there's something about letting that secret go and not being judged and releasing it and just getting it out that is really what they're most concerned with. And I think that Post Secret does that. It creates a safe, non-judgmental place where people can let that go for the first time. And so I don't think people want my help necessarily. And they almost all of them come anonymously, so it'd be difficult to reach out. But I do what I can. On the Post Secret website right now, there's a link to the most comprehensive and complete worldwide database of suicide prevention hotlines and text lines created by the volunteers at Post Secret. And so that link is available as a resource for anybody who might need it.
So if people really are feeling the need, there's some place to turn.
Exactly. There's always hope and there's always help. That's one of the messages behind the project. Sometimes you carry a very burdensome secret and it makes you feel isolated. It feels like this wall that's separating you from others. But I hope Post Secret is one of those tools that helps people realize their secrets are not walls at all. They're bridges. And if they can find a way to let it out to the right person, it can really offer them options and possibilities and hope that has always been there, but they might have just been blind to it.
Do you feel a burden seeing and hearing all those secrets? Do you sometimes think, "I can't look at another one"?
I think for some people who've had fortunate lives, it can feel depressing when you read some of these confessions, although there are some that are very joyful and talk about hidden acts of kindness and romance. But for me, I've had some struggles growing up. I've suffered some loss. And so when I see a painful, struggling secret, for me, it gives me a sense of solidarity. I feel like it's helping someone's voice be heard. And I think that's a noble calling to try and tell those untold stories.
And it's probably why people feel safe in sending them to you.
Yeah, when you mail a secret to me, it goes to my home address, not a P.O. box. My wife wasn't thrilled about that at the beginning. She really isn't to this day, frankly. And there are no paid advertisements on the blog, even though it's been seen by hundreds of millions of people. And I treat everybody's secret with respect and dignity. There aren't any snarky comments on the blog. And I think that's the reason that I've been able to earn the trust of strangers to talk about these bearing, exposing secrets that they've never told to their closest family members or their spouses.
So how did the stage show, which is what is coming here to Milwaukee, how did that come about?
Well, we've been working on Post Secret the Show for over 5 years now, and we're thrilled about where it is now. We have actors bring to life the secrets that have never been seen before, the stories behind them, secrets that have changed lives, brought people together. The actors themselves tell a real secret from their own life. It's kind of experimental. We invite audience members to write their secrets on postcards, and some of them are read back to the audience by the actors in the second act. In the performance, there is a dramatization of the most unforgettable phone call I ever took on the suicide prevention hotline. And there's also a scene where we share back with the audience actual voicemail messages that people in the Post Secret community have been keeping on their phones for years from friends and family members who have died. They talk about how those voices help them keep the spirit of their loved ones alive. And that's certainly an emotional part of the show, too.
Oh, yeah. Hearing that voice from beyond, almost like a beyond the grave kind of thing, is really intense.
Yeah, there's something about our cell phones that's almost magical, the way they can capture a voice, a spirit, a joke, a secret. Many people have told me about their phone-related secrets. One guy said, if my wife knew all the secrets I kept on my cell phone, we'd be divorced. Another time, I got a message from a young girl. She said, I still have the password to my ex-boyfriend's email account, and sometimes I read his messages, and they really make me angry. And then I got another message from a guy. He said, I know my ex-girlfriend still has my password, and sometimes I write messages just to upset her. So those two might be related.
I think they might be, yeah. Where do you see this project going? You've had 10 years of just exponential growth and interest. Do you see it evolving, changing, or is it serving what it needs to serve the way it is?
I just follow where the stories take me. It started as an art exhibit in Washington, D.C. From there, it became a popular blog, and then 6 best-selling books. And there was an app with Post Secret. There have been various art exhibits across the country, Post Secret live events that I'm involved with, and now the Post Secret show. So for me, that's kind of the highest expression of these stories. And I think as long as I continue to honor the secrets that people are trusting with me and make decisions in the best interest of Post Secret, the power of these confessions and stories will just find new ways to express themselves.
And they won't stop coming in.
They won't stop, and I frankly don't want them to. I've got 5 here in front of me, and if I can share these with you, it takes you on the full range of what people are sharing on postcards. This one has a drawing of an elevator on the face of it. It says, I feel guilty when I take elevators for one floor, so I limp when I get out. This one says, the man who sexually abused me is running for public office. This is one that came yesterday. It says, I really didn't know what it was like to be in love until I had children. And this one I've had for a while that reads, when my husband cheated on me, my best friend told me if I was meeting all his needs, he wouldn't be cheating on me. After my divorce, I had sex with her husband.
Oh, my gosh.
And then a romantic one I'll end with. This has a couple under a tree limb. It says, I didn't enlist to escape you. I enlisted to pay for our wedding. Will you marry me?
Yeah, I saw that one on the website today, and that one just tugged at my heart.
Yeah. These secrets are almost like invitations into a stranger's life and help us realize the extraordinary stories of heroism and frailty playing out in the people all around us, friends and family, right now at this moment.
And strangers, people we'll never meet.
Yeah.
And somehow we are all connected by all of this.
I think that's the ultimate message of the project. Maybe my favorite secret that I've ever received was mailed to me on a dollar bill. And the secret I found very profound, I make a copy of that dollar bill and carry it in my wallet all the time. It says, we're all part of something bigger, and we're all part of it together.
Well, Frank Warren, thank you so much, A, for the project, and B, for talking with us about it a little bit. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for the opportunity. It was great chatting with you.
Frank Warren is the creator of Post Secret. Post Secret, the show, plays in Milwaukee Thursday, March 1st at the Wilson Theater at Vogel Hall. More information is available at WUWM.com, and our interview with him first aired in 2016.
We'll take one last break and then have the next in our Bubbler Talk series. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM now. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
It's not uncommon to see historic homes when traveling across the city of Milwaukee. Sites like the Pabst Mansion, the Schuster Mansion, and the Villa Philomena, to name a few, garner attention from both tourists and even people who live in the city. These mansions are often hidden in plain sight, seemingly out of place among neighborhoods that have changed over the years. The Cavillage Sloss Mansion is no different. I'm Taryn Powell, and for this week's Bubbler Talk, two listeners, Randy Kepsel and Ann Lorenz, wanted to know the history behind the castle on Kilbourne. The huge three-story home sits on top of a slight hill near the corner of 24th and Kilbourne Avenue. The exterior is lined with Greek mythological-themed statues, and there's a railing made from iron, contorted into shapes of roses and seahorses. I visited the mansion to meet Jim Dieter, who has owned it since 2004 and lives there.
I was looking to purchase a home, and I looked in the Avenue West and Concordia neighborhood, and out of the quality of the homes in the neighborhood, this one actually had attracted me more because of the quality of construction and stuff and the history of the home.
The mansion was specially designed for the very first owner, Joseph B. Cavillage. He was the secretary and treasurer of Hoffman & Billings Manufacturing Company in Milwaukee. Cavillage lived there with his family from the 1890s until 1920. Since then, the mansion has had dozens of owners and uses.
Cavillage. It went into single-family home ownership for Percy Day. And then around 1926, the Roger Williams Hospital bought the Cavillage Mansion, and it became a full-fledge hospital.
Dieter says the hospital was the first in the Avenues West area and also the first hospital of record to take in African-American patients. He showed me some photos from that time.
Up in front. And then these are just more pictures of the nurses in front, sitting on the front standing.
Over time, the mansion also served as a hotel and an apartment building. In 1971, it was used as a Holy Family retreat home. But what might be more unusual about the Cavillage Mansion and its history are the details of its construction and those responsible for it. Otto Stack, the same architect who designed the Pabst Theater, was responsible for the mansion's architecture. The iron railings and chandeliers were done by Cyril Kolnick, a famous wrought iron artist in Milwaukee at the time.
See the owl? So they're wise. And then it's actually Poseidon up at the top. And those are they're the balcony up on top up there.
A love of Milwaukee history is what sparked our Bubbler Talk questioners Ann Lorenz and her husband Randy Kepsel's interest in the Cavillage Mansion.
It was in such an odd spot, too. You just kind of don't see it every day kind of thing. It's like, oh, we turned here and there it was.
She says she thinks it's important to try and preserve these pieces of Milwaukee history.
I think it's so interesting, just the history of the city and where it's been and where it's going and what it is now.
So if you're ever near 24th and Kilbourne Avenue, take some time to admire one of the oldest mansions in Milwaukee. Tours just might be available in the near future for you to take a peek inside.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in southeastern Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
And Bubbler Talk finishes Friday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, and Mayon Silver. Claudia Delgadillo is our production intern.
We get additional reporting from Rachel Morello and Susan Bentz, and studio engineering from Jason Reedy. Michelle Matanowski is WUWM's managing editor, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.